WIOX is supported by Home Goods of Margaretville, corner of Main and Bridge Streets in Margaretville, New York. Now carrying spices, flour, jams, mustards, coffee and tea, organic vegetables and fruits, and local cheese and baked goods. And, of course, cooking basics and tools of the trade for everyone at home. Home Goods of Margaretville. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 11 to 5, 845-586-4177 or hgom.net. WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, a critical access hospital offering comprehensive medical services, including emergency, cardiology, imaging, rehab, and a retail pharmacy. 845-586-1800. WIOX is supported by the Andes Hotel Restaurant and Bar, open Tuesday through Sunday for indoor dining or heated outdoor dining on the porch. Southern Cooking on Tuesdays, Wings on Wednesdays, Surf and Turf on Friday. Menus and reservations, theandeshotel.com or 845-676-4408. 845-676-4408.
Hi, this is Arnie Schwartz, host of Talk of the Town. Alternate Tuesday evenings from 6 to 7 on WIOX, Roxbury. Serving New York's Catskill region at 91.3 FM, WIOXradio.org, and MTC Cable, Channel 20.
Roxbury and the surrounding Catskills area, and also the rest of the world if you're listening at WIOXradio.org. It is 9:03, and you're listening to The Truth is So Boring, here with me, formerly known as the Meister, I now go by Owen, and my co-host over here.
I'm Scott, hello. Today we're doing a show. We're going to run through the history of the Levant region in the Middle East.
Our apologies.
And then focus in on some recent events in the town of Sheikh Jarrah, which follow the pattern of Israeli colonialism that has been ongoing since the mid-19th century. Today's show will have a little different format than our previous episodes. We have decided that the definition section at the front of the program is a little bit awkward for the format of radio. We still have our definitions noted in our notes here that we're going through, and
which will eventually be made public once the website works.
Yeah.
We're still working on that, folks. Apologies.
And I was just thinking, we really need to get that up by the next episode, because I want to be able to refer back to this episode during that one and
Absolutely.
Be like, go listen to that. Because we are doing a two-part episode on this, because there is a lot to cover.
A lot. Over 3,000 years of history, or 1.2 million if you want to go back to ancient history. the region known as the Levant, or Palestine, or Israel, or any other number of names, like Philistia was a Greek name for it, I believe, back in the day. I have a half dozen names written down somewhere in this document, but That was one of the first cradles of civilization. The agricultural revolution occurred in, among other places, there. I believe it is part of the Fertile Crescent. Correct me if I'm wrong.
As far as I know.
Yep. And let's see. That's the Fertile Crescent, of course, is the region surrounded by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. So we're talking a little bit more about the area next to, what is it, the Jordan River? Jordan's a river, right?
We're talking about the stuff on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. That's
okay.
You know,
yeah. So that's
really
kind
weird.
Of.
And because of that, it's a strategic location, and the history of the region, it's basically as long as the entirety of the history of the genus Homus. Homo.
Homus. Homus Simpsonus. The genus Homo, the one which we belong to.
Yes.
Us sapiens sapiens.
We couldn't do this region justice if we spent an entire year's worth of programs about it. So we're dedicating two full episodes with a focus on events most relating to the human suffering currently occurring in occupied Palestine. We begin this episode by considering the background of the region, getting into the detail of the historical record. Then we will discuss common misconceptions and rhetorical tics of how the media talks about this, and touch on events on the ground as much as time allows.
Yeah, the next episode will go more in depth into the current situation on the ground, political influences and policies, and any current movements or recent events which have unfolded in the time between now and then. This is a recent events program. We do like to wait until a story is fully mature and developed before digging into it fully so that we can get all the details as possible. But there is so much background on this topic that needs to be understood that we're gonna split this into a history and a more modern section.
Exactly, yeah.
So, here's a tidbit on some recent events regarding U.S.-Israel relations to keep in mind until next time. On May 5th of this year, the Biden administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to Israel, which that was nearly a week before reports on attacks by Hamas started blowing up in the news.
And so just to make a mention, it is 9:08, and you are listening to The Truth Is So Boring on WIOX Community Radio. Up next, we have a new segment, part of this show, called The Collapse Update, which is about the ongoing collapse of our...
ecology.
Well, ecology, society, all of that. And we need a drop for that. I didn't have time to get one, but we need something to put there, Bumper. A little fanfare, maybe.
We will figure that one out in the future, but for right, now we'll so just verbally intro
let's
it.
Let's take these one. I'll take one, you take one, real quick. All right.
Sounds good.
Due to microplastics in our environment, a 40-year study showed sperm counts have been dropping by nearly half. Dr. Shanna Swan hypothesized men will no longer produce sperm by 2045.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Oh.
Go on, quick.
Real children and men situation here. All right, next. BC's rarest forest ecosystems are rapidly disappearing.
That's British Columbia.
And if the province doesn't act immediately to defer logging in key areas, as recommended by the 2020 Old Growth Strategic Review, they will be lost forever, according to a report released Wednesday by a team of independent scientists.
The S&P 500 inflation-adjusted earning yield fell below zero this week. The previous times this happened were 2008, the housing bubble, 2000, the dot-com bubble, 1987, Black Monday, and a recession in 1973. This and many other signs point to the potentially impending collapse of the global economy.
Which is already kind of crumbled under COVID, so that's going to be fun. Record heat in Russia kicks off the Siberian wildfire season early. That fire was buried under ice and continued to smolder over the winter and then just broke out again this spring.
Yep. Secret recordings reveal officials discussing filthy conditions at 4,632 immigrant kids held in Texas tent camp.
And after nearly 2 years under house arrest, Stephen Donzinger's trial finished this week. The trial is a criminal prosecution by Chevron, not the U.S. government, the corporation Chevron, in retaliation for him attempting to hold them accountable for mass murder. He will likely be imprisoned. For more information, you can visit freedonzinger.org. That's FreeDonziger.org.
Okay, launching directly into our history section here.
We're going to talk a little bit about apartheid for a second, because we're going to be using that word a decent amount, and you're going to hear it from our clips in a decent amount as well, so we want to make sure you know what we mean when
so
we say that.
So you are doing a definition section this time.
Well, I mean, I just have some notes here on specifically that the history of the word apartheid that I think are quite necessary.
Oh, yeah, no, this is kind of a history lesson, too, not just a definition. So
I mean,
enough.
We just moved the definitions to inline, that's
yeah.
all.
Like, yeah.
they're still going to be here. You're not going to miss out on them. But, like, we figured it would be less clunky if we just defined things as they came up rather than, like, front-loading the episode.
Yeah, I do still want to put a heavy emphasis on making sure that what we say comes across as what we mean.
Yes.
Not something else.
Right.
The term apartheid from Afrikaans for apartness, which was the name of the South African system of
racial segregation,
which existed after 1948.
In 1971, the Soviet Union and Guinea together submitted early drafts of a convention to deal with the suppression and punishment of apartheid. In 1973, the General Assembly of the UN the General Assembly of the United Nations agreed on the text of the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid.
As such, apartheid was declared to be a crime against humanity, with a scope that went far beyond South Africa. While the crime of apartheid is most often associated with the racist policies of South Africa after 1948, the term more generally refers to racially based policies in any state. A key example is Jim Crow South America. That would also qualify as apartheid retroactive.
As in, like, the Southern American states, not like South America, South America, the continent. Jim Crow in America, the country, not America, the continent.
Anyway.
76 other countries subsequently signed on to this, but a number of nations, including Western democracies, have neither
democracies.
Well, yeah, quote unquote. A number of nations have neither signed nor ratified the ICSPCA. See if you can guess how many of these I'm going to say before I say them. Including Canada, France, Germany, Israel, ding ding, Italy, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. In explanation of the U.S. vote against the convention, Ambassador Clarence Clyde Ferguson Jr. said, "We cannot accept that apartheid can, in this manner, be made a crime against humanity. Crimes against humanity are so grave in nature that they must be meticulously elaborated and strictly construed under existing international law." Now, I don't know about you, but that definition that they gave us at the beginning of this little blurb seemed pretty freaking clear to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very clear and detailed, and that's clearly,
it's just a hand wave.
It's just a weasel. It's just legal weaseling out.
Yeah. So the U.S. still hasn't signed on to this, nor have all the other countries, and I think that does play a role in how the United States and those other countries approach the Israel-Palestine question, if you would.
Mm-hmm. I would go get your bell for you, but I don't think that we're going to have too many discussions of the 1970s in this episode. We're not going to have that many.
Sorry, folks, you're going to miss the cowbell today. Or not cow, hotel. Same difference, right?
Anyway, can we do the history now?
Yeah, why don't you talk about Mark Ruffalo?
No, I want to stow that.
Okay, never mind.
I want to stow that for next week.
Okay,
we can do some more. I don't want to do just one thing on...
Yeah, that does seem...
Like, yeah. Anyway. Okay. A brief history of the names of the Palestinian region or the Levant.
So it's not always been known as Israel, believe it or not. Despite
or Palestine.
Despite what the Bible might have told you. But one of the earliest...
I don't think it says that.
Israel? The word Israel is used in the
Bible.
Yeah,
Bibles. But I don't think... The Bible doesn't say that region has always been called Israel.
Okay. Well, I'm learning things today, folks. So, let's see. Did I actually write down my other names here? Or did I just write down that we were going to talk about it? Because it looks like I didn't write the names down. Well,
there's Palestine. Oh, no, that's different societies that have lived there.
No. Palestine was one of the most ancient names for both the people who lived in that region and subsequently the region. Peliset, transliterated from hieroglyphs as PRST, is found in 5 inscriptions relating to a neighboring people or land, starting from about 1150 before Common Era, before the 20th dynasty of Egypt. That's about 50 years before the first non-biblical reference to Israel as a people, not even referencing Israel as a country. The term Palestine, as we know it, first appeared in the 5th century before Common Era, when the ancient Greek historian Herodotus wrote of a district of Syria called Palestine between Phoenicia and Egypt in his histories.
Isn't that Palestine?
You can pronounce it however you want. It is not quite spelled the same as Palestine, but I'm just going to say Palestine.
Okay.
The name Israel first appears in non-biblical sources circa 1209 BCE in an inscription of the Egyptian pharaoh Merneptah. Now you might think, well, BCE goes backwards, right? Keep in mind that before Common Era dates are basically advance in the opposite direction of after Common Era dates.
Yeah, because they're going back.
Because they're before. So technically, 1209 would be before 1150. However, the inscription is very brief and only refers to a people, not an individual or a nation state. So it's about the pharaoh basically like conquering the people. The inscription says Israel is laid waste and his seed is not. That's some history on when it was called what, or at least when the people were called what.
Okay, then.
So mainly to prove that we are not coming to this conversation ignorant of the history of humanity in the Levant, I'm going to run through about 3,000 years of history here, listing the names of major human groups who have held control of the area prior to the Palestinian Mandate that Britain passed in the late 40s. Okay. Ancient Egyptians, Canaanites, Israelites, Assyrians, Babylonians, Achaemenids, Ancient Greeks, Romans, Parthians, Sasanians, Byzantines, the Arab Rashidun, I'm sure I said that wrong, the Umayyad, Abbasid, and Fatimid Caliphates, Crusaders, Ayyubids, Mamluks, Mongols, Ottomans, the British, and finally modern Israelis and Palestinians.
Efforts to confirm the Israelites' biblical origins through ancestry...
Archaeology. Sorry.
I had my second dose of the COVID vaccine this Monday, so I'm kind of still a little foggy.
Yeah, same here.
Where was I? Based on archaeological evidence, according to the modern archaeological account, the Israelites and their culture did not overtake the region by force, but instead branched out of the indigenous Canaanite peoples that long inhabited the southern Levant, Syria, ancient Israel, and Transjordan region through a gradual evolution of distinct monolatristic, later cementing as monotheistic, religion centered on Yahweh. The outgrowth of Yahweh-centric monolatrism. What's monolatrism?
So monolatrism is basically, it's a polytheistic situation where there is like a head god, I believe.
Oh.
I'd be happy to double check into that, but that's how it reads to me.
From Canaanite polytheism started out with Yahwism, the belief in the existence of many gods and goddesses of the Canaanite pantheon, but with the consistent worship of only Yahweh. Okay, so yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and efforts to confirm the Israelites' biblical origins through archaeology, once widespread, have been largely abandoned as unproductive, with many scholars viewing the stories as inspiring national myth narratives with little historical value. So basically, the prevailing academic opinion today is that the Israelites were a mixture of peoples predominantly indigenous to Canaan, which is, which is the same area as the Levant, more or less. Mm-hmm. Although an Egyptian matrix of peoples may have also played a role in their ethnogenesis, giving birth to the saga of the Exodus, with an ethnic composition similar to that in Ammon, Edom, and Moab, which are parts of present-day Jordan, and including Habiru and Shasu peoples, which were from Egypt. The defining feature which marked them off from the surrounding societies was a staunch egalitarian, and I put egalitarian in air quotes here because they were very patriarchal, and I don't consider patriarchy to be egalitarian, but compared to those around them, they were more egalitarian because their society cohesiveness was based around like the worship of Yahweh rather than just being related to each other, which most tribes of people were held together by kinship back in those days, you know, the Semitic tribes and such, you know, people talking about descendants of this and that person and whatnot, like that was very much the norm of how people organized themselves. So in that sense, compared to that, these people were slightly more egalitarian because they didn't really care who you came from, they just care who you worshipped.
Interesting.
Do you want to talk about
the
origin?
More inclusive?
Just like slightly more, but they still like, you know, I mean, patriarchy.
Yeah. The origin of the god Yahweh are currently uncertain since early Israelites seemed to worship the Canaanite god El as their national deity. Only to replace it later with Yahweh. It has been speculated by some scholars that the cult of Yahweh may have only been brought into Israel by a group of Canaanite slaves fleeing from Egypt, who later merged with the Israelites.
So Israel is a country rather than simply a people, because Israel is also the name for just the Jewish people in general, regardless of where they are. And that, I'm pretty sure, as a term, came first about the people, not about the
land. Well, yeah, that we mentioned that earlier about how the Egyptians used it in that sense first.
Right. So Israel as a country came about in 1047 before Common Era, nearly 100 years later than the earliest recorded use of the name Peliset. The kingdoms of Assyria and later Babylonia took control of Israel in 732 BCE, resettling up to 25% of the region's population, which I believe is one of the diaspora narratives, or it's like part of that, is a, which, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Biblical sources claim that the Babylonian exile, which I think is the same thing, happened during this time. In 539 BCE, Cyrus the Great of Persia, I'm sure you're familiar with him, conquered the area and gave Jews permission to return to Yehud, which is the name of the city at that time in the middle of Israel that was like mm-hmm. a ethnic center for them mm-hmm. before they were purged.
In 332 BCE, the Greeks conquered the Persians and then were conquered by the
Seleucids
in 200 BCE, who lost control in 167 BCE to the Maccabees, a group of Jewish rebels, which led the establishment of the Hasmonean dynasty. Herod's Rome takes over in 37 BCE, and the area is officially dubbed Syria Palestina.
I would like to note, because I don't think I got it in the notes here, the Hasmonean dynasty was a semi-autonomous Jewish rule. The area was still, like, control. Well, the area was sort of still considered by Persia to be a Persian thing. Mm. No, the Seleucids. I'm sorry. Yeah, they worked out a semi-autonomous rule, like, as a client state of the Seleucids, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Which is neat, but it didn't last very long. Christianity developed in the first century AD as a Jewish Christian sect of Second Temple Judaism. The Roman Empire becomes the Christian Byzantine Empire under Theodosius in 379 AD, and other religious practices, Judaism included, are proscribed, as in prohibited. Several Jewish revolts are tried and failed until the Persians succeed in 614 with help from Jewish rebels. This is reversed back to Byzantine rule barely a decade later in 628. A year later, nearly 150,000 Jews are massacred and expelled by Byzantines from Jerusalem and the Galilee.
Yikes.
Yeah. Not cool, folks.
Yeah. Islam originated in the early 600s AD in the Arabian Peninsula in Mecca. In 638, the successful conquest of Jerusalem by the armies of the Rashidun Caliphate, Islamic Empire, under Caliph Umar occurs. Caliphate competition ensues, and a Turkic ethnic group known as the Tilanids occupied Palestine and Syria in 878, enabling them to defend Egypt against Abbasid.
Against the Abbasid Caliphate's attacks.
Yes. In 970, the Fatimids, a self-proclaimed Shia Caliphate, took control and appointed a Jewish governor. The
Seljuk Turks invade in 1071, only to be recaptured by the Fatimids in 1098.
So that's interesting that a Shia Caliphate appointed a Jewish governor.
Yeah. I mean, they were... Okay, so when something that I saw a lot when I was reading about this is, generally speaking, when the Muslims were in control, for the most part, the Jewish people were kind of left to, like, do their thing. Hmm. Like, everyone had to pay taxes and stuff, but, like, I don't think there was the same kind of persecution that there was during, like, the Crusades, which we're about to get into, of Jewish people and, like, preventing them from being able to practice and blah, 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 blah. Like, the proscriptions happened under the Byzantines, which were Christian.
Yeah. Yeah, the Crusades began in 1099, and Jerusalem is captured by Christians. Crusades in the Levant end in 1291 with the fall of Acre.
Yep.
Okay, then.
I know, it's weird.
Control falls to the Mamluk Egyptians until 1516, with the conquest of the area by the Ottoman Empire. Between the mid-16th and 17th centuries, a close-knit alliance of three local dynasties, the Ridwans of Gaza, the Turabes of
Al-Lajun,
and the Faraks of Nablus. I don't know if you're supposed to roll that R. Anyway, they governed Palestine on behalf of the Imperial Ottoman government. And then in the 18th century, the Zaidani clan, under the leadership of Zayr al-Umar, ruled large parts of Palestine autonomously until the Ottomans were able to defeat them.
Napoleon tries and fails hard to capture Acre in 1799 as part of the French invasion of Egypt, which also famously failed.
Nice. Between 1830 and 1832, Palestine was conquered by Muhammad Ali's Egypt, but Egyptian rule was challenged in 1834 by a countrywide popular uprising against conscription and other measures considered intrusive by the population. Its suppression devastated many of Palestine's villages and major towns, which Britain took advantage of in 1840 when they assumed control of the area and gave it over to the Ottomans in exchange for capitulations.
Beginning in the 1860s, Palestine underwent an acceleration in its socioeconomic development due to its incorporation into the global and particularly European economic pattern of growth. I would call those one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
The beneficiaries of this process were Arabic-speaking Muslims and Christians who emerged as a new layer within the Arab elite. From 1880, large-scale Jewish immigration began, almost entirely from Europe, based on an explicitly Zionist ideology. There was also a revival of the Hebrew language and culture.
Christian Zionism in the United Kingdom preceded its spread within the Jewish community. The governor of the government of Great Britain publicly supported it during World War I with the Balfour Declaration of 1917.
Now here we get to talk about some really thorny subjects. World War I, Christian Zionism, and mandatory Palestine. Now you might be thinking to yourself, like, wait a minute, Zionism, that's a Jewish thing, right?
No. No, it's a Christian thing.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is a good point to stop and, like, just rehash all these dates that we just went over real quick. So, the country of the State of Israel originally, and Jordan, were only around, 1047 BCE to 732 BCE.
So that was like 300 years.
And the group who took over was the Babylonians. And
The Assyrians first, and then the Babylonians came in and swept the Assyrians.
Right. And so it changed hands so many times, and it's been a hotly contested region. Like, I don't know. I was raised in a very Christian Zionist household, and kind of the narrative went, you know, the Jewish people, you know, had this peaceful, you know, country that they had to themselves, where they were keeping it to themselves, and they were
after conquering the Canaanites, which didn't happen.
Well, we don't know.
Okay, we can't go back in time.
Yeah,
it's called archaeology.
I just the narrative that, like, this is, you know, such a simple A versus B, one group of people versus another, you know, the Israelites versus the Palestinians, whereas, you know, this has been a region that has changed hands more times than you can count. You know, it's not just one party versus another.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I care a lot more about who was living there when the colonialization, like, started than who happened to own it for a few hundred years BCE. Because
exactly.
Everybody owned it for a few hundred years BCE.
Exactly.
So, like, I'm sorry, but, you know,
just because
the Arabs, the Jews, and the Hittites have about as much claim to the area as, yeah, like, the Greeks do, the Romans, you know?
So, as we'll get to later, just because King David might have maybe once lived someplace doesn't mean you can tear down a bunch of people's houses and build a tourist trap for rich Americans.
Yes.
and... Yeah, I just, reading through, just taking a cursory look through the history, I mean, Islam wasn't even around for what, almost
until
1,000 years?
It wasn't around until 600 AD.
Yeah, so that's almost 1,000 years between whenever
Israel
was conquered and whenever the Islam was founded. But this is very often framed as like a Muslim versus Jewish thing, and it's just not.
It's not. The Muslims came later.
It's about colonialism.
It really is.
It's about people feeling like they have the right to come in and kick somebody out of a place where they live in. Okay, now back to mandatory Palestine. That's your cue.
Oh, all right. Immediately following the declaration of war on the Ottoman Empire in November 1914, the British War Cabinet began to consider the future of Palestine. Within 2 months, a memorandum was circulated to the cabinet by a Zionist cabinet member named Herbert Samuel, proposing the support of Zionist ambitions in order to enlist the support of Jews in the wider war. So, let's do Zionism so that we can get more Jew soldiers to fight for us against the Ottomans, basically.
Hmm.
Ideas of the restoration of the Jews and the land of Israel entered British public discourse in the early 19th century at about the same time as the British Protestant revival.
Modern Zionism emerged in the late 19th century in Central and Eastern Europe as a national revival movement, both in reaction to newer waves of anti-Semitism and as a response to Haskalah or Jewish Enlightenment. Soon after this, most leaders of the movement associated the main goal of creating the desired state in Palestine, then an area controlled by the Ottoman Empire.
Contemporary Israeli historian Anita Shapira suggests that evangelical Christian Zionists in England of the 1840s, quote, passed this notion on to Jewish circles, end quote, while Jewish nationalism in the early 19th century was widely regarded with hostility by British Jews. So they took some convincing. This didn't really start with the Jewish community in Britain.
Yeah.
I mean, it started with one Zionist who was Jewish, but that doesn't mean he speaks for all Jews. And I just want to point out, there are plenty of anti-Zionist Jews that exist.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
And I think a lot of them probably live in Israel.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917, prior to the end of World War I, during the First World War, announcing support for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, then an Ottoman region with a small minority Jewish population.
Now, I'm pretty sure there had been, like, a tiny little bit of colonialism. I'm not even going to call it colonialism because, like, Palestinians allowed Jews to, construct... I think that kibbutzes, like, back in the 1840s, I believe, I'd have to double-check on... Like, there were small settlements that were very amicable with the surrounding area that were... Like, I'm not going to call that colonialism because these were, like, amicable agreements that were, like, you know, the Palestinians were like, yes, you can use this land, after some Jews were like, hey, can we use this land? It's important to us.
That's the difference between colonization and immigration is, you know, are you getting along with the people who... you're moving in with, or are you bombing them?
Are you taking their stuff, or are you asking nicely and they're sharing with you?
Yeah.
It makes a difference.
The mandate for Palestine was a League of Nations mandate for British administration of the territories of Palestine and Transjordan, both of which had been conceded by the Ottoman Empire following the end of World War I in 1918.
So a League of Nations mandate was a legal status for certain territories transferred from the control of one country to another following World War I. Basically, terms by which winning colonial forces claimed conquered lands from losing colonial forces post-World War I. Now, if you are a recent social studies student in school, you might be familiar with... I remember in my textbook there was this picture of... like British, French, Italians, like a few colonial leaders carving up the world like on a platter.
I haven't seen
that. You haven't seen that. I need to track that down. I'm going to post it on our Twitter at Catamount Commie later because that is just that really encapsulates what happened here. It's literally just the winning colonial forces divvying up the colonial spoils.
Yeah, I don't know much about World War I, but I've heard that it was basically like a bunch of elites conscripting... like regular people to just go to fight their petty, you know, disagreements between each other.
Yeah, we'll have to do a World War I episode.
Well, I don't even know about an episode, but it's something that I've been meaning to, like, just, like, have a listen to somebody talking about or something.
Well, the 1910s and 20s and 30s were very important times for labor history.
Oh, that's a good point.
And, like, the history of labor and the war machine is very important.
That's actually a really good
understand.
Idea.
So we're going to come back to that in a future episode.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
As long as, I mean, you know, if stuff like this keeps happening, we'll have to focus on that.
Yeah.
A little bit of preemption there. Anyway, so does that do it for our history? Do you have any final notes? Anything you want to say?
Just one more note. According to the British, the objective of those mandates over former territories of the Ottoman Empire was to provide, quote, administrative advice and assistance by a mandatory until such time as they are able to stand alone, which I doesn't. Ring very true to me.
Yeah, so like the region was kind of autonomously functioning already because the Ottoman Empire was just leaving them alone and just saying like we technically rule this place and maybe they had to pay taxes or something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm sure they levied taxes, but I don't see much evidence that they changed
that there was
daily
those
life.
Three like we said there was those three tribes that were just basically like taking control of it like
the port.
They were just allowed to just be in charge and be on
their own. They were granted administrative power by the Ottomans, and so technically they were beholden to them, but as like go-betweens for the community, it seems to me from the historical record that they didn't like change daily life the way that like say the Byzantines did or the Babylonians did or whoever, you know.
Yeah.
Or whoever. That's not a confidence-inspiring phrase. All right. So, now that we've moved through some of the history, some of it, because there's no way we could get through all of it ever.
Yeah, this is like a gloss overview. Please check out, Wikipedia and, like, you know, there's
and then
tons
follow
of
Wikipedia
history books.
Sources. Yeah, we actually have a reading list later on that we're going to share with you, too, if you want more info on the history. So, misconceptions. We're going to talk about common misconceptions parroted by the media in support of an Israeli narrative. Yes?
Yes. Why is there no sound?
Questioner will ask an interviewee, does Israel have a right to exist?
Right. Do you deny that Israel has a right to exist, Adam?
Now, first off, Nima, no state, or at the very least, especially no sort of apartheid or ethno-nationalist or settler colonial state, which is to say a state that has a racial or ethnic criteria for citizenship, which Israel very much explicitly does, mm-hmm. especially the 4.5 million Palestinians under its charge in the occupied territories. Of course, they don't have a right to exist. You know, Rhodesia, or frankly, the United States, doesn't have a right to exist.
Right. Doesn't have a right to exist. Does Jim Crow South have a right to exist the way it was, right?
Well, even as writer Youssef Mounir noted in a piece in Forward magazine with the headline, "Does Israel have a right to exist?" is a trick question from 2019. I thought he put it well. He said, quote, "Can you imagine asking indigenous Americans and indigenous rights activists fighting for the rights of a population whose
yeah.
language, society's culture, and possessions were categorically decimated in the process of erecting the United States, whether the United States has a, quote, right to exist?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, does Mexico have to recognize the United States' right to exist on land annexed and claimed as a result of the 1846 Mexican-American War, like
what does that
where
mean?
Mexico lost 70% of its territories. Does Mexico have to recognize the United States' right to exist in that way? It doesn't actually mean anything.
Well, it's a way of... So what I think the implication of it is, and this is, I think, the real goal of it, and they'll oftentimes say, does it have a right to exist as a Jewish state? Because Hamas, on several occasions, has acknowledged Israel's right to exist, but not as a categorically as a Jewish state, which is, say, an ethno-supremacist state where those who are ethnically Jewish have a right to a specific neighborhood in Jerusalem that those who lived there for 70 years do not have that right because of who they are. And they said they did not because very few people are willing to co-sign their own ethnic cleansing, right? You're not going to say, my grandmother who grew up in this house, I agree, should not be able to live in this house by virtue of who she is. No one's going to agree to that.
And so the idea also, as you said, Adam, to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, quote-unquote, as a Jewish state, is then assigning Palestinians to second-class citizenry at best.
Yeah, I feel like the phrasing, you know, it's a trick question is pretty great because, like, I feel like what the intent of that is to make it sound like you're saying Jewish people shouldn't have a right to exist.
Yeah, it's supposed to, it does feel like it's supposed to entrap you in that sort of reasoning, and then the person who's talking to you can just point at you and be like, ah, you're an anti-Semite, nothing you say is true.
Yeah, that's not what anyone's saying.
Anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. You can critique something without being against it. And furthermore, I just wanted to point out a parallel. It seems to me the same kind of people who are interested in a Jewish ethnostate are the people who are interested in America being a Christian ethnostate, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the whole, like, white Protestant thread really, really seems to parallel the British Christian Zionist thread in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Best.
Well, another thing is, the goal, obviously, is to sort of imply that, because the talking point is that Jews deserve their own state like any other ethnicity. You have Sweden for this... You know, Swedes for Sweden, you have...
Yeah.
This is all...
Germans for Germany, maybe? Or Germany for Germany.
Wait. I got you one. Aryans for Hyperborea? Hyperborea was
you know more about history than me, apparently.
Okay, that was a Nazi thing. It was like, we're going to have an ethno-state up in the Arctic or something. Or, like, I don't know. It's a very metaphysical thing. It's weird.
This is, by the way, an EDL talking point.
It's weird and bad.
Brexit talking point. English for the English. And the problem with that is that there was people there.
Which was literally the colonial arguments made in the 40s. Swedes are indigenous to Sweden.
Sort of. But yes, we'll argue for the sake that they are. But this is the big hiccup Israel's settler colony, is that unlike, as we mentioned in episode 28, unlike previous settler colonies like the United States, Australia, Canada, etc., they don't have the luxury of full-blown genocide. To put it crudely, the reason why U.S. is not worried about demographic problems is because they killed the vast majority of Native Americans. There are, of course, still Native Americans here. There's, of course, genocide against the Native Americans still ongoing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right?
Look at Canada.
But the demographic threat is not urgent, so we can sort of provide nominal equal.
Look at the Keystone Pipeline in that.
Yeah. Keystone, Standing Rock. I'm just saying, in Canada, they're still, like, actively sterilizing indigenous people.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah.
Well, rights to them. Whereas Israel, because they engaged in a settler colony in the 20th century, where I think people were a little more, thankfully, a little bit more hesitant to do full-blown genocide, they're restrained by certain laws, certain mores, and certain norms that prevent them from engaging in full-blown genocide. So what they've lobbied for instead is a very slow process of ethnic cleansing that is more politically correct, which, of course, is what the whole nebulous peace process is for. And so in many ways, Israel's form of settler colonialism is far more humane than what the U.S. and Canada and Australia have done, largely by virtue of when it happened, and I would argue probably just kind of shifting norms around racist apartheid states, who are far more PR conscious than they were in the 19th century. I only say that insofar that I think that, you know, Americans should never be quite so smug about this. At least this is why all criticisms of Israel from the right are inherently anti-Semitic or bullshit. Because, like, if you believe in the American project or the sort of romance of the American empire, manifest destiny, and you criticize Israel for ethnic cleansing, physician, heal thyself.
That's what I was saying. I was just saying that. All right, it is 9:42 here at WIOX, Roxbury Community Radio, 91.3 FM and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi. Hello, I hope you're enjoying this. I hope you're getting a nice educational kick out of this today. I hope we're giving you something to talk to your professors respectfully about. You can also find us, of course, at MTC Cable Channel 20 and WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear.
Your professor may not want to talk to you about this because they might get fired.
They might. We're going to talk about BDS next time. We're just going to name drop it now and then walk away.
Yeah.
The common refrain that Israel has a right to defend itself.
So we saw numerous congressmen.
Oh, just to recap, we're going through common misconceptions and media tics that happen surrounding this topic.
There's people in the United States, obviously Israeli, pro-Israeli pundits. Joe Biden, the Joe Biden White House and Tony Blinken State Department themselves have used this phrase, Israel has a right to defend itself or defend herself. And we thought this was a good place to start because it is the definition of sophistry in that it's kind of superficially appealing, right? Say, Israel has a right to defend itself. So it seems on its face plausible. But aside from being amazingly glib and kind of macho, it presumes a kind of pristine defensive posture that's just not the reality. So even by saying Israel has a right to defend itself, it assumes automatically that there's an offensive party who is violating their national sovereignty.
And that is not Israel.
And that is not the case, right? And the idea of having a right to defend yourself as some sort of inalienable or sort of universalist principle ignores the fact that they are an occupying force over an occupied people, a settler colonial state that has a population that is fighting back. We can debate the sort of moral properties of the means of which they're fighting back all you want, but they are fighting back from an occupied force, and that under international law, and not that we care too much about what international law says, but occupied peoples, people under military occupation or colonial subjugation, have every right to fight back. They have every right to defend themselves, whereas the occupier does not have such a right. And so it is kind of the definition of a macho kind of non-statement, right? It sort of, it sounds appealing until you, because it assumes the listener doesn't really know what the hell's going on.
Right, exactly. That Israel can be seen as the perennial victim in this narrative, that Israel is merely reacting, defending itself, protecting itself, as opposed to the aggressor, the occupier, the committer of violence, first and foremost, and the one that has one of the most modern killing machines, militaries,
supplied by us
on the planet.
Well, not only that, but the largest weapons manufacturer by per capita.
The most high-tech weaponry, and deploys this upon the people of Palestine with horrifying regularity and oftentimes will use Gaza and its inhabitants as almost like test cases for new weapons, for chemical weapons like white phosphorus or other egregious munitions that destroy human bodies. The Israeli military often will test these weapons on the population in Gaza before then selling them to the rest of the world.
Yeah, such as the US. So the idea of Israel's a right to defend itself, then one is followed up to ask, does apartheid South Africa have a right to defend itself?
Yeah. Or, you know, did people have a right to do lynchings in Jim Crow South?
Or, yeah, do people have a right to not... Okay, never mind. That was
All right. Yeah. Let's go on with the next thing so that we don't run out of time.
Yeah.
Hamas, or alternatively, all Palestinians writ large, must renounce violence.
They'll sometimes say terror, but usually they just mean any kind of violent resistance.
Right. To renounce violence. It doesn't say stop resisting. It says renounce.
A quick note here, since we're talking about terrorism and how that can kind of... be misconstrued to make you think a certain thing. This is something that would have made its way into the definition section, but we dropped that, so I'm going to inline that definition right now. According to the U.S. legal code, terrorism is anything that involves acts of violence or acts dangerous to human life that violate a state or federal law, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of government by mass destruction and assassination or kidnapping. So, stuck right in the middle there. Nice, you know, you might glaze over it a little bit if you're not paying attention. Any action intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. So basically, any form of protest.
Ha! I thought we had a right to that.
No, that's terrorism.
Okay.
Yeah.
Violence. Now, of course, this demand only goes one way. It doesn't go to the occupier. It doesn't go to the settler colonialist. Israel never has to renounce violence. That is never a demand.
So I did a survey, rather, of the New York Times over a 10-year period. I did it in March of 2019. Article in fair.org with the headline "Renouncing Violence is a Demand Made Almost Exclusively of Muslims." I did a survey from 2009 to 2019 of New York Times articles, and I found that 95% of the time demands of renouncing violence are made entirely to Muslim organizations, peoples, or parties, primarily Hamas and the Taliban. There are zero instances in the Times between March 28, 2009 and March 28, 2019 of anyone, either in an opinion or non-opinion context, suggesting the U.S., Israel, or any white-majority country renounce violence. Almost 50% of those were directed towards either Palestinians or Hamas, telling them to renounce violence. Roughly a third went to insurgents in Afghanistan. So the thing is that the renouncing violence canard is even extra silly in the context of Palestine, because there's nowhere else for which they can appeal. They have no electoral process because they have no franchisement. They can't vote. There's no alternative other than violence within Palestine to show one's displeasure.
Except, say, I don't know, BDS, that are also criminalized.
Hmm. But even that is, yeah, well, it doesn't, you know, in the context of Israel, it doesn't really mean much. It's an international solidarity thing. So there's a long history of this. People fighting British colonialism in Ireland were constantly told to renounce violence. There's a 1990 op-ed in the New York Times by David G. Sanders entitled, "Why Won't Mandela Renounce Violence?" Which he said, well, Mandela needs to be more like Gandhi, because Mandela, for years, for over 20 years, he was in prison for 27 years.
Gandhi was a pedophile.
Mm.
Pretty sure he molested his own niece when she was 13
gross.
Or some shit. Oh, man, excuse me.
Virtually the entire time of Amnesty International was created in 1961, and Mandela was refused prisoner of conscience designation because he refused to denounce violence, which I think we've talked about in the show before. Because those in resistance struggles, even by these kind of bourgeois Western human rights groups, right, which not only accept the premise that colonial powers have a monopoly on violence, but they should, like, use it well, I guess.
Right.
But they also have the parallel liberal demand that those who are being oppressed denounce violence, even though, again, the idea that we would go up to President Biden or President Trump or Obama or Netanyahu and say, will you denounce violence, where you hand over all your weapons and hand over the $800 billion military.
Obama denounced violence?
Absurd, right? So only one party's ever told to denounce violence, because it's a it's unilateral disarmament. It's suicide. You would have to be, and Mandela would say this. He'd say, Mandela, why don't you denounce violence? He's like, you have to be fucking mad right. to denounce violence in the face of a racist apartheid regime. Why would I foreclose on that pathway to resistance? It doesn't make any sense.
Especially when violence is visited on the oppressed every single day.
Right, I mean, themselves?
If the quote-unquote violence from Hamas in Gaza, so currently the rocket fire, right? Before the rockets are fired, during when the rockets are being fired, and after the rockets stop being fired, mm-hmm. Israel's occupation and apartheid and blockade and siege and colonization of Palestine continues, right? Like, that is the constant. That violence, that two-tiered legal system in the West Bank, the apartheid regime across the entirety of historic Palestine, within the Green Line and outside.
The claim by these Israeli settler organizations that the land in Sheikh Jarrah once belonged to Jews, you know, they're using kind of like land deeds from the Ottoman Empire to prove this. And there's question marks about how valid these land deeds are. Some of them may be forgeries, some not. But what's interesting is that they're not saying we have to return this land to the people who owned it. They're saying that because Jews once lived here, then any Jew could then move in and kick out the Palestinians who live there now. And that's why you get, you know, Jacob from Brooklyn moving in to these families' houses. At the same time, I mentioned that the Sheikh Jarrah families are originally from, you know, near Haifa. Israeli courts don't allow them to make a claim to return to their houses that are still there. So the Israeli courts will hear any case for any Jewish organization that wants to reclaim the land that, you know, a Jew might not have lived.
Often funded by wealthy people from other countries.
Lived in for hundreds of thousands
we'll
of years.
We'll get more into that.
But a Palestinian who's still alive and says, you know, I want to go back to the house that was mine a few decades ago. The Israeli court system will not hear that argument. We're not allowed it. And that is kind of a testament to the apartheid system that Israel is running against Palestinians.
Hamas is firing indiscriminately into Israel and that they use human shields. This exists to explain away...
Okay, the human shield thing only works logically if they care about not hitting the people being used as shields.
Oof. Yeah, that's true.
Rather large discrepancies in death toll. So,
right.
For example, the death toll in the last major quote unquote conflict in 2014.
Oh, no, that's actually kind of what the point is.
It was 1,500 to 6, as we explained in the previous news brief. 523 children died in Gaza. Right now, there's roughly 30 children who've died. This will probably be bigger by the time you're hearing this. 100 civilians and Palestinian civilians have died. 3 Israeli civilians have died. These numbers will probably be more or less the same. It's usually between 100 to 300 to 1, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gets explained away, Nima, with this idea that, A, Israel does target... They do these knock raids. They sort of... They throw a mortar at a building before blowing it up.
Right. It's called roof knocking, which is so incredibly sick. And
which is just a PR thing. It doesn't mean anything. Because the mortar kills people anyway. And also, it's difficult to hear where it comes from.
Exactly. It's when Israel is going to destroy an apartment building or a house or a home, it will first drop what Israeli PR spokespeople refer to as a small bomb,
a little bomb
on the roof of the building to warn the people inside that a bigger bomb is coming. And so, therefore, if they do not immediately evacuate their homes, they will be reduced to rubble. Now, so much of this is not only collective punishment, is clearly a war crime, but the premise itself, I mean, and it even seems silly to get into this, honestly, because it's really just about propaganda, but the premise itself that you would warn the inhabitants of a building that you allege has terrorists in it, and you warn them, but then you think all the civilians are going to leave, but, like, the Hamas guys are going to stay there. None of it makes sense. So all you're doing is this PR gambit that the Western press laps up.
Trevor Noah on The Daily Show started off a very, very rather unfocused. I mean, I could see what he was trying to say. We're not going to play the whole thing because it's very rambling. It's very long. He was trying to sort of gently point out the body count asymmetry, the power asymmetry. And this is kind of a good, this is a liberal line people use. I don't necessarily mind it because it is important that people understand that. But he prefaced this by saying, I don't quite know everything. Everything's very complex. And this, what it does is sort of shrouds it. You know, John Stewart himself, as we talked about episode 28, said they've been fighting for thousands of years. Obama said they've been fighting for thousands of years. Now, of course, the concept of Arab is fairly modern. And
Zionism is less than 150 years old. So,
and the Islamic religion is less than 1,400 years old. So how do you fight for thousands of years if it's religious? So it doesn't make any sense, right? It's the way of reducing the occupation to some sort of sectarian conflict that has been around for thousands of years. And it's fundamentally a Zionist talking point. And if you don't even believe that, then at the very least acknowledge that the side responsible for 96% of civilian casualties is the side that your government backs and supports
America.
To the tune of $3 billion a year, $3.8 billion a year, whereas the other side you have no, you can't impact. Like what you and I say on this podcast has zero influence on what Palestinians are ultimately going to do either way, right?
Right.
But we have some say and some control over the government that we fund and ostensibly who operates in our name. And at the very least, even if you don't acknowledge the fact that this is not some mystical ancient sectarian conflict, but is in fact an ongoing settler colonial project and a form of, at the very least, we can all agree, is a military occupation of the vast majority of Palestinians, then that's it. That's all you really sort of need to understand.
All right, that just about does it for this episode. We have a couple quick notes before we go. Owen wanted to recommend a couple books. We will get more into detail on the events on the ground. This episode has turned out to be entirely background. And
which is important.
I suspected that would happen.
Yeah, me too. I'm all right with that. So we got, do you want to do the clip credits first?
Yeah, right. So today's clips came from, where'd it go? Chapo Trap House 523. No, we didn't wind up using anything from that.
We recommend it, though.
Citations needed news brief debunking the five most common anti-Palestinian talking points. In this public news brief, we break down the most common anti-Palestinian tropes and why they're based on sophistry, ignorance, racism, or some combination of all three. We also heard briefly from Chapo Trap House bonus focus on Palestine featuring Muhammad
Al-Safin.
Yes, that. I was, yeah. The summary for that is Felix is joined by journalist AJ for AJ Plus, Mohammed Al-Safin, for a wide-ranging discussion on Palestinian resistance and the future of Zionism and the Palestinian cause. You will hear more from that episode during our next episode, where we follow up on this with current events. Now, on to Owen's book recommendations.
Well, I just want to drop one more podcast as well, because we did shout out to Steve Donziger.
Well, that's part of the podcast recommendations that I wanted to do after your book.
Oh, okay. That's fine. That's totally fine. Okay, yeah.
That stuff's off topic.
Okay. So if you're interested in learning more about the history of Palestine, of Israel, of Zionism, I have a few books to recommend. I mean, I'll probably be told that these are very biased. I would say they're biased towards the oppressed. One of them, at least, is written by an actual Palestinian woman who's also a fighter in the area and had to, like, grow up there and deal with it. So all right, we're going to start with The Hundred Years' War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi. Beginning in the final days of the Ottoman Empire, Khalidi reveals nascent Palestinian nationalism and the broad recognition by early Zionists of the colonial nature of their project. This is a great history book. Again, that is
sure.
The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. Next, we got Israel and Palestine by Ian Carroll. That's two L's, Ian Carroll.
Two R's.
He starts 4,000 years ago, so that's about as far as written history exists in that area, so he really starts at the beginning there. Next, My People Shall Live by Leila Khaled, Palestine from a Woman's Perspective and a Fighter's. You get to see for yourself the demonization of resistance in all its means, peaceful or armed. That's the one that was written by the woman who actually lived there. And finally, Freedom is a Constant Struggle by Angela Davis, really great abolitionist writer. Reflecting on the importance of black feminism, intersectionality, and prison abolitionism for today's struggles, Davis discusses the legacies of previous liberation struggles from the black freedom movement to the South American anti-apartheid movement, highlighting connections and analyzing today's struggles against state terror from Ferguson to Palestine.
Sure, and I just had a few podcasts I wanted to recommend. These are